In 1951, a 16-year-old girl led her fellow students in a walkout and strike to protest substandard conditions at her segregated high school in Farmville, Virginia. In his January 2010 inaugural speech, Virginia Governor Bob McDonald recalled the pivotal role of Barbara Johns in the historic student walkout.
Barbara Johns was willing to risk everything for the simple opportunity of a good education. Surely, nearly 60 years later, we can work together to provide that opportunity for all Virginia children.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, the student strike that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Hold on.
On the grounds of the Virginia State Capitol, a crowd of people cheers the dedication of a new civil rights memorial, cast in bronze and featuring 18 figures arranged around a large granite block. One of the figures is of 16-year-old Barbara Johns. She didn't live to see this commemoration in July of 2008, but her grandchildren were there.
I'm Andrew Harrison. I'm from New Jersey. I'm the grandson of Barbara Johns. I just can't even believe it right now. I mean, my grandma is such an inspiration. I wish I really got to meet her.
My name is Alexis Harrison. It's an honor to be the granddaughter of Barbara Johns. It really inspires me knowing that anyone at any age could do anything that they put their mind to.
The story of Barbara Johns begins 60 years ago in Robert Russa Moton High School in Farmville, Virginia. It's 1951, and the school is in wretched condition. There isn't a gymnasium, cafeteria, or teacher restrooms. There aren't even enough desks or blackboards. The overcrowding means many students have to take classes in tar paper shacks, and others have to learn inside an abandoned school bus. Enter Barbara Johns, the niece of Vernon Johns, a minister who'd long been active in the civil rights struggle. Fed up with poor conditions at the school, Barbara forges notes to teachers, instructing them to bring their classes to the auditorium for a special announcement. When they show up, she and fellow students take the stage, and Barbara rallies more than 450 students to walk out. Together, they march to the homes of school board members, who've repeatedly refused their petitions for a school that is equal to that of the white school in the county. Here's Barbara Johns talking about that walkout in a rare 1978 interview.
We wanted so much here and had so little. And we had talents and abilities here that weren't really being realized. And I thought that was a tragic shame. And that's basically what motivated me to want to see some change take place here.
Today, Moton High School isn't a school. It's the Robert Russa Moton Museum, and it serves as a center for the study of civil rights. Lacey Ward Jr. is museum director, and he recently sat down with two people who participated in the 1951 walkout, Reverend Samuel Williams and Joyce Cabarrus Speaks.
Many people who visit Virginia today are going to come to know Barbara Johns because of a memorial on the Capitol grounds in Richmond, Virginia. But I think what our listeners today want to know is, who was Barbara Johns, and who was Barbara Johns on April 23rd, 1951? Who'd like to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I feel that Barbara Johns was a brilliant person. She was a very attractive person. And Barbara took a lot of walks, did a lot of praying for answers to what she felt was a problem.
What did Barbara do? And tell me, were you surprised by it?
I was very surprised by it. We were shocked because that day when we were called to the auditorium for assembly, we thought that it was just the principal calling us in. But when we got into the auditorium, all of us, and the curtain opened, there was Barbara Johns along with the others, Carrie Stokes, John Stokes, and others that were on the committee.
And Reverend Williams, you were there that day too.
Yes, I was there. And there was a lot of cheering. There was a lot of listening. There was some booing and so forth. And I know that we had made comparisons and contrasts with the high school and our school, inadequate facilities that we had. They had what we would regard now as state-of-the-art equipment. So we were not informed of all of this things that were going on, transpiring in the auditorium at that time.
And I want to bring into the conversation also what I feel really triggered Barbara to push this track forward. Her best friend was killed in the bus accident that took the lives of 5 children coming from school because they were in the bus that they were riding on was a secondhand bus.
Tell us a little bit more about that for those who don't know.
Okay, the bus accident happened when they were leaving school, taking the children home. That was at Elam Crossing. And it was 5 kids that belonged to the same family that were killed. But then also, Barbara was taking care of her siblings because her mother was working away and her father was busy with the farm, and she had to take care of her siblings. And this day, she was getting ready for school. She sent her sister and brother down because she forgot her lunch. She went back to get her lunch, and when she came back, the bus had passed, and she was left on the side of the road to try to get a ride to school. An hour later, she was still standing on the side of the road, and the white bus passed by that was half empty. And it didn't stop because they could not pick her up and take her to school. And that put it really into motion, mm-hmm. that this bus is half empty, and I'm standing on the side of the road. I have to do something about it. And that night, she said she turned and she prayed and she asked God to put something into her mind so that she could really do something about this frustration. And that's when she went to the school the next day and she got the committee together, which was John Watts and Carrie Stokes and John Stokes.
And Reverend Williams, I want to ask you one thing. Most students who listen to this today are going to think, well, what would my parents have thought? What did the parents make of all of this?
There was a lot of ambivalence among the parents. For instance, we went from one extreme to the other. Go back to school. You may not have the state-of-the-art equipment as to what white people have or in the white high school, but I didn't have that when I attended school. Go back. Then there were others who said, no, you stand your ground. Protest what white schools had and we did not have. For instance, they had a modern science lab. We did not. We had just one microscope for, 400 and some students. They had first aid room, teacher's lounge. We didn't have any of that. Our coach would get together with the white coach to let us go over and practice the night before the game so that we could get accustomed to playing at night. We didn't have lights on our field. They did. And these are just something that we use to point when people can show you something that's above abstract.
You can show it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what about your parents? What was the reaction?
Well, the day of the strike, when I went home, I was more fearful of what my grandparents were going to say than I was on any other repercussions at the time. But when I got home, my grandmother, who was a teacher also, she said she did not think it was right. My grandfather thought that it was a good idea because he had been going back and forth down to, the superintendent and everything. Eventually, she was convinced to come on the other side. The parents had been fighting for a better school for a long time, and they didn't get it. So the children just got ahead of them and were able to put it into motion. A lot of the parents that had children, they were able to have them work on the farm for the 2 weeks that they were on strike. So that played a role.
Were you one of those? You got to do some farm work for 2 weeks?
No, I had to do farm work all the time.
Okay.
After school, on the weekends, and whatever.
There was this event. Students decided to go on strike. You're out of school for 2 weeks. A month later, lawsuits filed. And I guess everybody by then is back in school. Did things go back to normal, or what was it like the rest of that school year?
I think they pretty well went back to normal. At the time, I was like 12 years old, but we went back to school. Classes were as they were before we went on strike.
But how about Barbara Johns in the rest of that school year?
Well, Barbara Johns was sent to, I'm trying to remember that, but she was sent to live with her uncle, Vernon Johns, in Montgomery, Alabama, because of the threats on her life. But the thing is that anything that you do, you have to make a sacrifice. There's a sacrifice for everything that you can do that you achieve something from.
Many students in school today don't even know that there was an event of some magnitude. Why is it people don't know about Prince Edward County, Virginia, or don't know about Barbara Johns and the student strike?
There was only a certain amount of information that the white control in power wanted to get out of Prince Edward. And it's a gentleman's like agreement in Virginia. People did not really want it to be known. So much has been hidden on purpose, and much has been hidden from school, from students, even at the college level, along with university that's there. Mm-hmm. Keeping black history away from black people, keeping black history away from white people mainly, and everybody else, other racial and ethnic groups, because it is so shameful.
There at the state capitol, there's a quote attributed to Barbara Johns later in her life. It seemed like reaching for the moon. 60 years after you all as students took this action, the classrooms you studied in will become exhibit space. And, of course, Barbara Johns won't be here with us to see that. Explain to her what you're seeing today.
I would tell Barbara that she did reach the moon in her time and her season. And what she did will show a young person, a young man, a young woman, that they can change government. They can make a difference in this world and in this nation. All they have to do is stand for what they feel should be changed. And we just wish that she could have been to see what change she made in Prince Edward County, in America, and for so many citizens.
Thank you so much. Thank you both.
You're welcome. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity.
Sure.
That was Lacey Ward, Jr., director of the Moton Museum, speaking with Reverend Samuel Williams and Joyce Cabra Speaks, who both participated in the 1951 student walkout. The student strike in Farmville, Virginia, occurred 4 years before the actions of Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott, 6 years before the Little Rock Nine crisis, and 9 years before the sit-ins throughout the South. Larissa Smith Ferguson is a professor of history and government at Longwood University in Farmville. Standing in the halls of the former Moton High School, she explains why the walkout in Prince Edward County doesn't hold a more prominent place in the history of the civil rights struggle.
I think there's really two reasons for that. One is the timing of the walkout itself. It occurred in 1951, and this is before really most Americans had televisions. And certainly it was a secret that the boycott would happen. And so there was no time for media to get here in the first place. But I think really many of our memories of the civil rights movement and our public memory of the civil rights movement is shaped by what we see on television. And really much of the Moton story, the Prince Edward story, happened in classrooms and happened before the advent of television. The second reason why the Prince Edward story has been overlooked is because of the place of Virginia in civil rights history, and that much of the Virginia story has been left out of this grand narrative, as one scholar calls it, where it's centered around Martin Luther King Jr. and the activities of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the Deep South states of Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. But I think that in many ways, the 1951 student walkout here is a sort of hinge point between earlier civil rights struggles that often resulted from a moment of direct action. When Irene Morgan in 1946 refused to give up her seat on a bus in Gloucester County, Virginia, that resulted in a court decision, a Supreme Court decision in 1946 that banned segregation in interstate transportation. As yet, it would take the 1960s freedom rides to really make that elimination of segregation permanent. And so in this way, sort of, I think what the students did also helped to launch a chain in the event of events that would eventually result in the desegregation of public education in America.
Larissa Smith Ferguson is a professor of history and government at Longwood University.
May I have your attention, please? Fellow students, many of you know me. I am Barbara Johns. For too long, we have quietly accepted the hand-me-downs that end up in this school. I say no longer.
That's a scene from Strike, a film about Barbara Johns. It was shot on location at Moton High School. Tim Reed, a well-known actor and founder of New Millennium Studios, directed the film, and 17-year-old actor Courtney Jameson plays Barbara Johns.
When I first saw Courtney, she had a certain look and a certain power that just immediately struck me. Someone who was very confident and very self-assured. So I wanted her to understand what the country was like then. And the more we discussed that, the more I wanted her to understand what courage it took for this young woman and how you could find within yourself that essence of character. And she was able to do it.
I just tried to get to know the story, and I will admit, I went to Wikipedia. A lot of students my age go there to just, you know, read up on information. So
there are some who tell us that we should be content with what we have, that someday in the future, things will be better. When will that day happen?
I think it's mostly just about students becoming united. A lot of teens need to watch this because it's so powerful, and it really inspired me to want to go out and become a mentor and become somebody who's making a difference in my community, even though I'm young.
Our parents tell us to be good students. In church, we are told to read the Bible. Well, the Bible says that a little child will lead.
There's a sense within every person who sees this that there's a way to achieve change and a way to achieve a goal that we've thrown away. We're more in the aggressive, the more we think we can shout our way to freedom. We think we can shout our way to change. We think we can embarrass people to be who we want them to be. We think that, no. We just went through and going through political system now where everybody said they wanted change. And as soon as change came, everybody was resistant to change. It's the most ridiculous thing in the history of politics. We all want hope. Well, here's hope. Oh, we don't want that hope. We want our kind of hope. If you mean change like we got to change something, no, we want change without change. Well, these young people, when they said they wanted change, they actually meant it. And they were willing to sacrifice whatever it took. There are repercussions to change. And I don't think today we understand that. Now, hopefully these young people, when they come out of there and know that this school still exists as a symbol to change and what can be accomplished through this kind of change, that they'll have a better view as opposed to what they're getting from the politicians and the pundits today.
Tim Reed is an actor and founder of New Millennium Studios and director of the film Strike, in which Courtney Jameson plays Barbara Johns.
And I have been one of your public servants who has fought throughout that time to prevent the mixing of the races in the public schools. And up to this moment, there is no mixing of the races in the public schools of Virginia. And there is no turmoil, no confusion, no chaos as a result of that.
That was Virginia Governor Lindsay Allman in 1959, attacking integration and vowing to maintain segregated schools. During the strike, Barbara Johns and fellow students sought legal counsel from the NAACP, which agreed to assist as long as the suit would be for integrated schools and not just equal schools. Next, the courts upheld segregation in Prince Edward County. The NAACP then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and this case, along with four others, became part of Brown v. Board of Education that was the beginning of the end of segregated education in America. In 1954, the Supreme Court ruled that separate but equal is unconstitutional. In states where segregation had existed since Reconstruction, the decision was met with hostility. These states enacted policies of massive resistance, and some school districts suspended public education completely. While most white children entered private schools, many black children went uneducated. Mildred Robinson is a professor of law at the University of Virginia and co-author of Law Touched Our Hearts, A Generation Remembers Brown versus Board of Education. Moton Museum Director Lacey Ward spoke with Mildred Robinson.
Mildred, what's the book about?
This book grew out of a relationship between a colleague of mine at UVA and myself that started in 1984 when I came to Charlottesville as a visitor at the law school. Richard is a Southerner, as am I. He was born in Virginia. I was born in South Carolina, and we immediately hit on the Brown experience as a common denominator. Since there were 17 million school children in segregated schools in 1954, it was pretty hard to think of a way to get our arms around a sample, but we finally decided that we would turn to our colleagues in the Legal Academy to ask if any had been affected by Brown, and if so, to tell us just a little bit about that experience. It's not as attorneys, but as children.
Wow, wonderful. And I don't mean to pry. You mentioned the dates of birth for people who would be in the survey. Were you and Richard part of that group?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We were both born in 1944, so that makes us 60-plus, a very vital 60-plus.
I just wanted to know if you were within the range. And,
oh, yes.
And you mentioned you were born in South Carolina.
That is
correct. Richard born in Virginia. And I guess even in Virginia, it played out in different ways. Well, which one would you like to start with first, sharing with our listeners?
I think it's kind of interesting to get a little bit of background. We've got one writer who was in Fairfax, was in high school. And he writes
His
name is Earl Dudley. He was my colleague here at UVA. He is now retired. But he was in the ninth grade when Brown was decided. And he was in Fairfax County. And he describes it then as being very rural and very southern. He describes it as being rigidly segregated, little or no residential segregation. White folks and black folks, and again I quote from the essay, lived right next to each other, for the most part quite amicably, but everything else was segregated, not just the schools, but the restaurants, the lunch counters, the theaters, and for the most part, even the stores. As far as I ever discovered, I was the only student at Herndon High whose parents told him that the Supreme Court got it right. This was itself quietly remarkable, for both my parents had been born and raised in poor white families in Tidewater, Virginia. Indeed, I believe on the basis of anecdotal evidence that, at least before World War II, my father shared all the typical prejudices of his time and class. 3 years in a Japanese internment camp during the war changed all that. He describes a debate that took place in his high school, which was organized by Mrs. Alger, who was his civics teacher, I believe. She decided to seize the moment, after the Brown case was decided, to do a little educating. When she asked for volunteers for the debate, there were many for the pro-segregation side, but initially I was the only one who stepped forward to support the decision. Finally, a very pretty and lively girl with an innate sense of fairness and the marvelous name of Dixie Lou Simpson volunteered to join me in defending the court. Dixie's parents, who just moved to Northern Virginia from Alabama, certainly had not told her the Supreme Court got it right, and I'm quite sure Dixie didn't think so either, but she and I worked diligently to prepare our arguments. After the debate was over, Mrs. Alger asked for a vote of who had won, and Dixie and I garnered a solid majority. I don't mean we made converts, but at least Mrs. Alger got us talking in civilized tones. The next few years in Virginia were filled with not very civil arguments about race. Often the air was blue with racial epithets. Liberal and moderate voices were hard to hear in the din.
You've so far touched on urban areas. Any rural areas enter into?
I think Danville probably would.
So let's go down south and kind of see how it played out in Danville.
All right. The next writer wrote an essay entitled Standing Up for Brown in Danville. His name is Richard Bourne. And he was born in November 1942. He is now a professor of law at the University of Baltimore in Baltimore, Maryland. He was 11. I don't remember much about my family's reaction to Brown, except that they thought it was high time for the court to rule as it had, and that they were generally elated about the prospects for change it augured. The next day, the kids were milling around the schoolyard. They were full of anger and resentment and suggested that integration would never come to Danville, Virginia, where we lived. He goes on to say that he went away to prep school at Andover in September of 1957, and I quote, "I was the only kid from my Danville High School who went to school with Negroes. As part of its massive resistance to federal desegregation policy, Virginia enacted legislation that allowed any parents who wanted their child educated in private schools to get a tuition grant from the local government where the child lived, with reimbursement to come from the state. My father decided to take advantage of the program to spite the system. The deans at Andover and my father got a chuckle out of the fact that I was the first kid from the state of Virginia to get a tuition grant. The local white populace was furious because we weren't using the money for the purpose it was intended, to flee integrated public schools."
We began today's program exploring the roots of Brown, or at least the Virginia roots of Brown, and beginning at Moton High School with Barbara Johns and her fellow classmates. Any overarching remarks or findings you might want to discuss, maybe relating Moton, its impact, Brown, the decision, and how it's influenced your life and the lives of your colleagues as you've seen through this editorial process?
I think that the lesson that we took away from our experience was that a broadened experience, a broadened existence was important to formulate the way we thought about ourselves and the way we envisioned our world. Until the Supreme Court handed down its decision in 1954, there wasn't any way of attempting to explore to learn that important lesson. I think one of the greatest tragedies that is presently evolving in this country is toward greater rather than less separation. I think people don't have the ability to talk to each other anymore or seem to be losing that ability. I wish that we could think constructively of ways to thwart that and to reverse that trend.
Lacey Ward Jr. is the director of the Moton Museum. Mildred Robinson is a professor of law at the University of Virginia and co-editor with Richard Bonney of the book Law Touched Our Hearts, A Generation Remembers Brown versus Board of Education.
Hold on.